get yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell, and the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to hometown. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we have a special show today. What's happening in Latin America? What is this obvious right word swing here, new right offensive? And how much is the U.S. behind the scenes pulling the strings, aiding their corporate and reactionary friends? As the U.S. pivots, we hear a lot about a pivoting in recent years in the U.S. towards China. Yeah, but there's a pivot been going on for at least a year, 18 months, focusing, intensifying U.S. trying to shift Latin America back into its fold here after a period of obvious independence and people going their own way with progressive governments in Latin America. The U.S. doesn't like that. And now that they've been trying, as I've said before, to establish a status quo in the Middle East, they are returning now to focus not only on China, but on Latin America. Okay, we have a special guest here today who is going to share with us some of his reflections on what's actually going on in Latin America. Not some gringo who thinks he knows it all from the north, but someone who is there on the scene, has been for some time, and has a unique perspective given the position. This is Pablo Vivanco, who from Valparaiso, Chile here, who's been active in various social movements and struggles, former radio host of Voces Latinas, who lives in Quito, Ecuador right now, and is the director of the English division of Telesur Media Latin America, a consortium of various Latin American country TV media online resources here. He is also active in various progressive changes in Latin America, and as the director of the English division of the Telesur in Ecuador, has a unique perspective to share with us on what's actually going on in Latin America. You know, you can't read the New York Times and really know what's going on because they reflect the positions of the leading capitalists in this country, especially when it comes to foreign policy here. So there really aren't very many good sources to find out really what's going on in Latin America. I would share with listeners, though, if you really want to find out what's going on, go to Telesur Media. And I'm sure Pablo will share with us some references where listeners and the audience can go and find out, not only right now, but as this very critical juncture year for Latin America continues here. Pablo, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon to you, Jack, and to all your listeners. Thanks for having me on.
Right. And I hope everybody listens to and reads Telesur here for a source of what's actually happening day by day in Latin America. You know, just a little introduction myself. What we've got here is a right-wing offensive that's gaining momentum throughout the South America here. We know their long history of U.S. efforts to aid reactionary forces and corporate forces, multinational companies and so forth, to disrupt Venezuela's economy. And I've written about that and talked about that. Taking advantage of the global oil collapse here, the U.S. has intensified its efforts to destabilize and disrupt Venezuela's economy, speculating in its currency, causing its currency to collapse, which causes the shortages of goods and services and the hoarding of dollars and so forth. The U.S. has played a very direct role in doing that, setting up offshore speculators to disrupt the currency flows and cause the shortages. And the U.S., of course, has indicted many of supporters of the Venezuelan economy and government, including military and business people visiting the United States, trying to intimidate them to neutralize business support and military support for the Maduro regime there. And, you know, that intense fight is going on, and I'm sure Pablo will share some latest views on that. But we got an attack going on in Brazil as well. Forces trying to use legal scandals as a way of disrupting the government and moves to impeach the newly elected president there, a re-elected president, Dilma Rousseff. And, of course, we know Argentina, where they've already succeeded in overturning the progressive governments there and have in their pocket, the U.S. has in its pocket, this Macri government. In fact, they like its Macri so much that they've Obama went down and visited him just recently. You know, give him the endorsement, public endorsement. And this Macri government is clearly a class-based government. First thing they do is reward the hedge funds, the Paul Singers, the vulture funds, U.S. vulture funds, who weren't being paid by the Brazilian, I mean, not the Brazilian, the Argentine government, because they were gouging speculators in bonds that disrupt the governments and the economies of all these countries, and they did that intensely a decade or so ago until we had a change in the government there. And the Argentine government, progressive government that's no longer in power, refused to pay the excessive demands. They paid off some of their bonds, but they refused to pay off all the excessive demands of the vulture funds or hedge funds, Paul Singer and company. And now with the new Macri government, the first thing the Macri government does is, oh, we're going to pay off these guys, you know, which means the business people and the speculators and the bankers in Argentina now will get some free money. They'll be paid off. They'll get some free money from global banking institutions now, and that's really what it's all about. At the same time, of course, they're laying off thousands and thousands of government workers and cutting subsidies and so forth. So this is the offensive going on down there, and I've said enough here. Pablo, I want you to tell the audience, jump in anywhere, whatever country, whatever issue, tell us what's going on in Latin America.
Well, yeah, it's a lot to kind of sum up in a couple breaths. Like you said, obviously with the backdrop of the collapse of oil prices, the steep drop in a very relatively short period of time, it's affected not only the governments where there's progressive forces in power, but the region as a whole. I mean, you can see similar situations in Colombia or Mexico with currency devaluations, with austerity measures due to decreased state revenues, Mexico and Colombia also being oil exporters. So this isn't something that is just affecting Ecuador or Venezuela or Brazil. Venezuela obviously being disproportionately affected because of the amount of its GDP and particularly its exports that are oil dependent, but it's a regional phenomena that's really impacting the entire all of Latin America. And I mean, the statistics show it. The region, I think this year is projecting less than 1% growth, and that's precisely because of everything we're seeing in the world economy. The conservative political forces in the continent had been ramping up their activities, both on organizing demonstrations and for example here in Ecuador over the last couple of years, the conservative forces have been trying to mobilize on the streets. Continually, they've been failing here. But in other places, they've been having more success, for example, in Brazil, looking to regain what they'd lost, the territory, the ground that's been lost over a bit more than a decade with what I think some folks generally call the pink tide, left-wing parties gaining government in a number of regions, a number of countries in the region. Obviously, the more important economies of the region, Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela. And through that, pushing forward not only a redistribution of resources, which has dramatically reduced poverty across the region, but also in an uneven way, presenting a new sort of political project in the region, a transfer not only of wealth, but of power, a transfer of decision-making. You know, we can see this, for example, in communication laws that have been passed in Bolivia, Ecuador, Argentina, Venezuela, which have redistributed the frequencies, the airwaves, away from the media monopolies that unfortunately still control, but at least legally gave more ground to community media, for example, which is, I'm sure your listeners know the importance of, obviously, you know, being patrons of progressive radio. But that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. You've mentioned Argentina and the fact that just this last fall, by a relatively slight majority, Argentinians, they elected a right-wing government headed by Mauricio Macri, a billionaire in the country who was the mayor of Buenos Aires, who defeated Daniel Scioli, who was the representative of the Frente para la Victoria, which was the party that was headed up by Néstor Kirchner and then later Cristina Kirchner de Fernandez. Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, pardon. So he obviously came to power in December, and within 100 days, obviously implemented a lot of things you've been talking about, renegotiating with the vulture fund creditors, and is going to put Argentina in more debt to the tune of somewhere around $10 to $11 billion, which will have to be assumed by the Argentinian people. Has laid off tens of thousands of employees, up to 100,000 by some estimates. And over the next month, the Argentines are going to be hit with increases to gas, electricity, transport prices. We're talking major increases to all of these basic utilities. But not only that, the Macri government is also attacking its political opponents' media. Myself, as you know, obviously I'm the director of Telesur English. Telesur being a project of a number of different governments coming together and launching this regional network. Argentina being a stakeholder within this project, the Macri government announced that they would be pulling out as stakeholders. But not only that, they announced that they would also potentially be looking to close down our offices there. Them pulling out as stakeholders also impacts Telesur's ability to be broadcast to people. Right now it's because of the fact that it is considered a state broadcaster, it's available to around 80% of the population through the public airways, as well as through the regulations that the Argentine state has with private cable companies around the channels that need to be available through at least some cable packages. All of that would be removed. But Telesur is not the only victim here in this. Just yesterday, Pedro Villeguer, a very prominent journalist who is a commentator for the national television station on a number of issues, on air actually declared that the public authorities that told them that they no longer want him on air, so that he said publicly again that he doesn't know how long he'll be on there. Victor Hugo Morales, a Uruguayan journalist who's been in Argentina for a number of years on national public radio. About a month after Macri took office, he was also, about 5 minutes before he was about to begin his program, was given his pink slip, as well as, you know, a number of other shows that were canceled on public broadcasters by the Macri government. Like, you're seeing some pretty significant censorship that's being instituted by the MAGA government. And obviously, all of this in the backdrop of President Obama just visiting Argentina, not only to, just as part of a regional visit, but specifically to try to highlight Mauricio Macri as a defender of human rights. So, insofar as you can see some level of complicity from the U.S. government, I think the recent Obama visit really underscored it, where not only was the Macri government's economic and political program really supported by the Obama government, Obama specifically saying in a press conference that U.S. authorities were impressed with what Macri had been able to do within 100 days. Obama stating that it was important and a positive step that that Macri was willing to negotiate with the Vulture Fund creditors. But as I stated, Obama going on the 40th anniversary of the start of the U.S.-backed military coup, which began the brutal dictatorship that led to the disappearance and death of over 30,000 Argentinians. Obama highlighting Mauricio Macri as supposedly a human rights defender while he's actively attacking critical media in the country.
Yes, very interesting. And listeners should realize that this recent decision by the U.S. Federal Reserve not to raise interest rates in the U.S. Has a direct benefit to the big speculators and stock and bond traders and so forth in Argentina. In other words, by not raising interest rates, the capital flow out of the currencies do stabilize, and the capital flow does not occur as much out of these countries. And the stock and bond markets, since Macri came in, have boomed in Argentina. So Macri, produces an immediate, massive financial gain to investors down there. And, the U.S. plays the investor connection to assist these right-wing and business governments, business-dominated governments, not just in Argentina, but everywhere. People should know that the U.S. indirectly supports and promotes and buttresses these governments in various ways. We'll find out more as time goes on. The U.S. playing a backdoor role here in helping this Macri government come to power. You know, the U.S. has so many different vehicles and agencies and so forth, which become conduits for financial aid and other resource assistance and expert assistance to its friends in these various countries. So, we may not see the full hand of the U.S. behind all this, but we will. We will see it eventually. The process is only really beginning down there, unfortunately. What can you say about what's happening in elsewhere in South America, Brazil? What's your take on what's going on in Brazil?
Well, Brazil obviously is starting to garner a lot of media attention, Brazil being, as I stated previously, the largest economy of Latin America, and in a lot of ways kind of the guarantor of regional stability. I think in a lot of analysts, in terms of looking at the paint, have thought of Venezuela as being a bit of a linchpin. However, Brazil, at least in my opinion, is the center of all of this, precisely because of the fact that as the largest economy, as the largest country, as the largest military, on some level has maintained some level of cohesion with a lot of the projects that have been begun throughout these 15 or so years of this pink tide. In Brazil, although the PT has been winning the executive of the government since the early 2000s, they've never actually been in control. The PT being the Workers' Party, which began in the process of social movements organizing themselves and coming together to oppose the dictatorship in the 80s in Brazil, but obviously to counterpose a progressive agenda. They've never won the legislature in Brazil. Brazil's legislature having a multitude of different parties with obviously different interests. So the PT has in large part been running through a coalition, a pretty tenuous coalition. Even before this, you could see lots of defections within the PT folks that were, within the ruling coalition, folks that were ministers, leaving the government, subsequently running as presidential candidates in a number of different times. With parties that kind of have left-sounding names, most of Brazil's political parties have some sort of left workerist orientation, at least in name. But over the last while, obviously Brazil has been embroiled in this corruption scandal revolving the Petrobras, massive the state oil company, which is obviously massive because the Brazilian state and economy is massive. And it has implicated virtually every party in Brazil. However, obviously the focus has been on PT and the also some of the members of the ruling coalition kind of seizing the opportunity to try to strike PT, which has been, like I said, been able to at least have hegemony over the executive over more than a decade, first with Lula and then with Dilma. So even though Dilma has not been implicated in any of the corruption scandals, some of the members of the PT have, that's for sure, but there's also the members of the main party that has actually been for impeachment now of Dilma, the members of the PMDB, which are have been part of the ruling coalition, but Eduardo Cunha, who was the speaker of the lower house, he's one of the people that's most implicated in this corruption scandal, money laundering, etc. This is not just about a corruption scandal. This is about political opponents of the PT utilizing this opportunity to try to subvert what they couldn't do at the polls, which was get the PT out of the executive. So they've been mobilizing on the streets, obviously with impressive numbers, but again, remember that Sao Paulo is a city of 20-something million people. So to get several hundred thousand people on the streets, it looks impressive, and obviously you can't say that there isn't widespread discontent around the fact that there is this corruption scandal happening. However, to represent it as that this is at least playing out, that the majority of Brazilians want what the people on the opposition side in the street want, I think is also a little contentious. There's been massive demonstrations, millions of people last week demonstrating on the opposite end, opposing corruption, opposing austerity cuts, but also reinforcing the idea that the democratic will of the Brazilian people have to be respected. People don't have as short a memory as some folks in the opposition, would like to project. People remember that they had to fight hard for a vote, that they had to fight hard to eliminate a dictatorship. And unfortunately, some of the calls on the streets have been for a military intervention, to the extent that actually high-end military officials, the head of the armed forces, has actually had to make public declarations against those calls because of the fact that it's not just a negligible group of people within that opposition that are calling for this. So when we're talking about a right restoration in Latin America, it isn't just about, neoliberals wanting to come in and reinstitute free trade agreements. And of course they want to do this. But you have a reactionary, undemocratic segment of this population that kind of yearns for that period of the 70s and 80s where it wasn't just about right-wing policies. It was about authoritarian governments that quelled the left, that squashed the left in violently. So it's fairly dangerous what's currently happening Brazil. The attempts there, they go far beyond just, you know, trying to get to the bottom of a corruption scandal. They are actually trying to undo progress that Brazilians had to fight for decades around, and the recuperation of their democratic institutions, and that could have reverberations across the hemisphere. Obviously, there's concerns, and some folks are talking. President Correa from Ecuador talked about a Plan Condor being afoot. Plan Condor being the CIA sponsored program between military governments in the Southern Cone to snuff out left wing activists throughout the 70s and 80s. Obviously, right now, that expression of violent attacks against activists is localized to places like Colombia, but nonetheless, what everything that's happening right now is starting to look actually kind of scary.
People should know that you know, the economic crisis throughout South America and Brazil in particular is the cause of global developments. And what we've got is this business right-wing move trying to exploit that. Sometimes, you know, the right-wing in New York Times tries to paint a picture that these progressive governments are economically, managerially inept. But the crisis in South America is driven by the collapse of global oil and commodity prices and the collapse of currencies as a result of U.S. Interest rate and currency policies, and a slowdown in China. In other words, the reasons for the economic crisis, and Brazil is in its worst recession since the Great Depression of the 30s, for example, the reasons are global and beyond the control, in a large extent, of these progressive governments. And you know, their opposition, their right-wing opposition, sees the opportunity to exploit this, as does the U.S., and they are taking advantage of this and blaming the governments. And, you know, there's a pattern here and everywhere that I think is being managed and engineered, and that is to raise the issue of scandal. In other words, to create the impression in the general populace that these governments, duly elected democratic progressive governments, are corrupt, and to distract and blame the crisis on this question of political corruption, which is easier to mobilize people around. And that's a pattern we see everywhere. In Brazil, it's corruption, Petrobras, and the Workers' Party, PT, and even attacking Lula, who was the head of the Workers' Party and led Brazil into its best economic years of performance in decades, who is not in government now. The attack, as you know, has been extended to Lula as well, and the fight goes on in Brazil on many, many levels. But in all these cases, whether it's Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, there's always a legal offensive that the U.S. Supports through its courts and world courts and so forth, and global dominance of financial institutions, you know, like Federal Reserve and IMF and so forth. So, you know, listeners should realize that the crisis in South America is not made by South Americans. It's made by others primarily, and the crisis is being manipulated and exploited by conservative business interests, and, of course, not just business interests, as you pointed out, but in many places in Latin America, there's this deep agricultural families, the latifundia or whatever you want to call them, who have had great power for years, and they are perhaps among the most reactionary, and they still have a large position, influence in these countries. And when the opportunity arises, they you know, like algae on a pond, they rise to the top. Anyway, thanks for this overview of Brazil, which, you know, I would urge readers to go to Telesur, and a lot of Telesur English. You know, if you don't read Spanish, that's okay. There's an English division in there in the opinion section. Go to Telesur Media and go to the English edition and opinion section. And, you know, a lot of good writers are talking about events of the day, what's going on day to day. And you can get a different view. You won't get a New York Times of what's actually happening there. Can you tell us something about the latest events in Venezuela? There, of course, as you've pointed out, in Brazil, the Workers' Party never had control of the legislature, and Brazil and in Venezuela, they've just lost control. The progressive Maduro government has lost control of the legislature there, and there's a battle going on between the government and the legislature, and they're both maneuvering around the Supreme Court, each trying to get another lever. And by the way, the Supreme Court battle, who controls the Supreme Court, is something that goes on, that's going on in all these countries. And ironically, it's going on in the U.S. as well right now. What's happening in Venezuela as you see it most recently, Pablo?
Yeah, obviously, there's a lot going on in Venezuela. But one thing I wanted to emphasize with you talking about in terms of how the economies managed by left-wing governments in Latin America are generally portrayed by the media, and I think it's the impression that even a lot of progressives in North America have, that there's mismanagement, that ultimately this is just another evidence that socialism or left-wing economics are bankrupt. The best-performing economy in Latin America currently is Bolivia, and that needs to be kind of underscored, because it demonstrates that even in spite of the regional crisis, there's countries that because of their particular economic structure as well as some of the policies have been able to manage the crisis better than others. Venezuela, unfortunately, has not been able to escape the fact that its complete economic fabric is structured around oil. This is not a making of Hugo Chavez or Nicolas Maduro. This was the making of about 100 years of the Venezuela. The Venezuelan oil has been, they've been exploiting their oil since the turn of the 20th century. And the entire economy began to be geared towards that through the better half of the last century. So that pretty much, a lot of their agriculture was decimated, but that was in the first half of the 20th century. When Chavez came into power, not only did, in 1998, not only was the Venezuelan economy still oil dependent, but it was obviously a very rich country with a terrible inequality. So for pretty much the entire time of the Bolivarian Revolution, what their economic and social program has been to take advantage of oil prices, which obviously were at or around or sometimes above $100 a barrel for the better part of 10 years or so, and investing that into the Venezuelan people, investing that into infrastructure in the country. And that's what they did. But obviously that didn't change the matrix of the economy of Venezuela. They still were oil dependent and were obviously taking advantage of those oil prices. Here comes 2014, and with a drop in oil, obviously they've been significantly impacted, have been trying to do their best as a result of, and obviously resisted implementing austerity measures. Just last year, in 2015, they built 1 million homes for people, because if anyone who's been to Venezuela and has actually been beyond, the typical sort of tourist traps will tell you, the one of the main issues in the country has always been housing. The majority of people in the urban centers live in makeshift communities, often in really precarious housing. And this has even had tragic consequences beyond the issues of equality and urban planning and all that sort of stuff. In 1999, there was 20,000 people killed in landslides, precisely because of the fact that they lived in makeshift housing in a certain area, thinking torrential rains, and all those people were swept up by landslides, by mudslides. So obviously it was a priority, it was a necessity to address that situation. Right now, what's been currently happening is obviously the opposition was able to bank on a lot of the discontent within Venezuela around this economic situation, the inability to have a currency, and also I guess their import dependency, and what's resulted from that, which has been that the private sector folks, importers, have been taking the larger producers, the few that there are in the country, have taken advantage of the situation, have created an artificial scarcity in the country, and so people have been lining up throughout the country for basic goods. And obviously it's a situation similar to what happened in Chile in 1972-73. I myself am from Chile, and I wasn't around then, but from parents, from all the people that I grew up, from the images that anyone can see themselves, it's a mirror image of what happened in Chile. The objective here an objective that at least they were able to, the opposition was able to capitalize on during the elections, was to create discontent. As Nixon famously said, to make the currently the Venezuelan economy is screaming. It's screaming as a result of the oil prices and what Venezuela is no longer able to do with a barrel at $20, which is just kind of flood their society with subsidies and whatnot. They're having to readjust things, but the opposition was able to capitalize on that. They won a majority for the first time in 16 years, and now control the National Assembly. However, what they ran on, which was ending the lineups, addressing the discontent of Venezuelans, they haven't been doing that. They instead have been focusing on what their end game is, obviously, which is to get Maduro out of the Miraflores, the presidential office. They launched the campaign a couple weeks ago, where they stated they've started a three-pronged strategy of street mobilizations, as well as an attempt to change the constitution within the National Assembly, reducing the presidential term from 6 years to 4 years, and also in April that they'll begin a recall referendum. In Venezuela, the president, just like any other public office, can be recalled if the population gathers enough signatures, goes through a process, and then there'll be a referendum. Obviously, one of the concerns here is beyond the sort of back and forth and the battles that are happening in the National Assembly and how that's playing out with other institutions. You mentioned the Supreme Court. There's also concern around what calling for street mobilizations mean. Just 2 days ago, two police were killed, four seriously injured, when student demonstrators, and I say that, in quotation marks, student demonstrators, hijacked the bus and then just ran it into police lines. We saw that in February, starting February 2014, there was violent demonstrations that were called by sections of the opposition. It ended up with 43 people being killed, hundreds injured, billions of dollars in property damage, and we're not just talking like roads and street signs. We're talking about community centers, community clinics, daycares were attacked, precisely because a lot of these things are symbols of the Bolivarian Revolution, are symbols of what the government has brought to underprivileged, underserviced communities, and so that those are focal points of the opposition to attack. So Venezuela right now is embroiled in this situation of the executive versus the National Assembly. The National Assembly not acting like a National Assembly, the National Assembly instead acting as the spearhead for an opposition strategy to remove the democratically elected president from the position that they were elected to be in a similar way as they're doing in Brazil, the National Assembly now completely focused on trying to get Dilma out of office. So once you start putting these things together, you start seeing that this is a regional strategy, that these are not isolated incidents, because similar things are being employed across the region. And also the actors are moving from one place to another. Some of the leaders of Venezuela's opposition were in Argentina for the elections when the demonstrators here in Ecuador were trying to rile people up over the opposition was trying to rile people up over a proposal from President Correa to institute taxes on capital gains and inheritance. There was Venezuelans that were going into buses and riling people, attempting to rile people up, saying that, oh, if they didn't watch it, if they didn't participate in these demonstrations, that Ecuador would also turn into Venezuela. These are not coincidences. There's a regional movement and a regional strategy to try to topple the governments, to try to take advantage of the global economic situation that you described, Jack, and to utilize that, to capitalize on that, to do what they haven't been able to do over the last 15 years, which is win at the polls. If they can't win at the polls, they're trying to topple the governments by force or by other means. But obviously, as already happened in Venezuela, this is costing lives. So there's the concern that these things are not just part of, you know, kind of the regular political games that people are used to, that these things could actually end up turning into a political violence, as they actually already have, perhaps on a smaller scale, but that these things could balloon.
Yes, for the listeners, when you said Venezuela is dependent on oil, they should understand that 97% of government revenues come from global oil. And when your price per oil drops from $150 a barrel to $40, then it's like the U.S. government failing to recover $2.5 trillion in taxes. You can imagine if the U.S. government had $2.5 trillion, what would be cut, right? It would be devastating. Well, that's what's going on in Venezuela, and it has nothing to do with Venezuela. It has to do with initially with the U.S. and the Saudis, U.S. Oil gas frackers, and the Saudis trying to prevent the U.S. oil gas fracking surge in oil from stealing Saudi market share. So the Saudis dropped the price of oil, refused to raise the price of oil, and then you have slowdown in China, big oil consumer as well. And that's the source of the global oil collapse, and Venezuela's caught in the middle of this. And, you know, a government deprived of mostly of its revenue it is going to have difficulties, and it's just the kind of difficulties that I think Obama and the U.S. say, now there's a great opportunity here. Let's strike while the oil crisis is hot here, and that's what's happening. And on top of that, the U.S. is doing all it can from afar and internally to cooperate with U.S. multinational companies in Venezuela and other Venezuelan companies. To hoard cash, to hoard dollars and hoard cash, which causes the shortages. And the shortages, of course, are being exploited by the right wing. For folks who don't understand the global oil price developments and currency developments, you know, all they know is that they can't buy something in the store. So this is a classic, as you have pointed out, it occurs in Chile the same way. There's a classic model here, how you economically destabilize a country, and Venezuela is a key repeat example of that going on right now. And then it turns political. It helps the conservative forces get a beachhead in the legislature. And from that beachhead in the legislature, the counter-revolution goes from economic to political, and they attack the executive. And if they can, in the meantime, gather the court system under their wing, even if they have to change the Constitution, And what we see here in Venezuela and these other countries, Brazil and so forth, is how this right wing has no respect for proper vote and democracy. These are attacks on governments going on that were just reelected popularly. And you've got these conservative forces. I wouldn't even call them conservative anymore. I'd call them reactionary. They're trying to turn things back to, as you pointed out, the way things were in the 70s and 80s. And if they can gather all the political institutions under their control, they will do just that. What they will do, you can get an indication of, you know, the Macri government and massive austerity and cuts for everybody else and, you know, big subsidies and maneuvering a currency and stock markets for their rich friends. This is a classic, intense class-based conflict going on there in Argentina and in Venezuela and in Brazil, where the fight right now is over the Supreme Court. You know, who's going to gather the Supreme Court? Because the right-wing legislatures will use the Supreme Court as a vehicle to attack. Whatever they do legally, they will then have, attacking the government, they will then have the Supreme Court bless and legitimize. So the fight is over now in Venezuela and in Brazil, controlling the Supreme Court. But that's just a stage, a step in the whole process that's going on down there. Okay, that's my addition to, you know, your excellent comments there, Pablo. What is going on in terms of the resistance to this in these three key areas or any other area? I know similar stuff is going on, not as intensely, but in Bolivia and elsewhere. But what is what's the resistance? What are the workers' parties and progressive governments doing to defend and counter this obvious economic and political counter-revolution that's building in Latin America?
Well, obviously, there's the response from that social movements always have, which is to take the streets. Obviously, there's always the strength in numbers and the accumulated experience of social movements in Latin America. Has always shown that going out into the streets is always an important and a central part of any strategy, even not only just to oppose things but also to support them. So that has been an important element in Argentina, where there's been mass demonstrations on Monday. There's also going to be strikes from teachers. There's already been strikes from other public sector workers, and we can count on that continuing. Argentinians also, like, I mean, if folks remember what happened during the Argentinian economic collapse in 2001, folks took out to the streets for not for days, for weeks and months. And so Argentinians will be doing this. I think some of the folks that you know, perhaps forgot what had happened there and voted for Macri. Now, shortly, they're going to end up seeing what that means, and there'll be certainly a growth in popular discontent once these increases in utility prices take hold. In Brazil, the allied movements of the allied youth, the landless peasant movement, who, mind you, a lot of these movements that have are part of and have been supportive of the PT have also been critical of the PT and some of the concessions that particularly the Dilma government was making for a period of time around implementing cuts in light of, you know, this global economic situation. Nonetheless, they are adamant about the fact that this doesn't mean that's how you're going to give up on, you know, the democratic institutions that they've fought so hard for. So that they've also been taking to the streets across Brazil. Just yesterday was another mobilization. There's more planned. There's also been folks that have gone out to confront police when police have attempted to go to Lula's own personal house, which again, like, we didn't really kind of touch upon that. Aside from the campaign against Dilma Rousseff, there's also, like you mentioned, a campaign. Lula da Silva has been brought into this, particularly after he announced that he would be interested in throwing his hat in the ring in the next presidential election. They've gone after him and tried to implicate him in another related corruption scandal with a large infrastructure firm from Latin America, Odebrecht. Again, nothing, no evidence, but a lot of innuendo, which is, you know, part of it's hard not to see that these things are politically motivated when the judges that are handing down the orders for investigations are posting pictures of themselves in opposition rallies. You know, you can see how all these things are deeply political. So in Brazil, again, similarly, there's mobilizations in order to defend the government and defend the popular will and the democratic institutions and allow these things to be subverted by a handful of people. The Brazilian Congress is still 500 people. And again, 500 people, of which a lot of them are also implicated in the same scandal. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are messy and happening in Brazil, and the right wing, the conservative sectors, the monopolies in Brazil, you know, taking advantage of this in order to try to sweep the PT away. In Venezuela, Venezuela has 15 years of accumulated experience in precisely this. If there's one strength of the Venezuelan process, among many errors, among many other weaknesses that a lot of even the Venezuelan leadership recognizes and has been recognizing, one area of strength has been popular mobilization, the politicization, the consciousness raising among a broad section of society, so that now you have you know, thousands of community organizations, thousands of organizers that have been politicized through this process, so that even in spite of, you know, the lineups and all those things, I was just there last November and I saw this myself. I saw the lineups, but still you still had 40-something percent of the population still go out and defend the process, even in spite of all the economic difficulties. This demonstrates that they haven't built up political patronage. What they've built up is political consciousness, and that consciousness manifests itself not only at election time, but also on the streets. The supporters of the Bolivar Revolution have continued to mobilize and are continuing to try to find solutions to the situation that they're facing. Obviously, it's very difficult given all of the things that are taking place right now in the country, and the little maneuver room given the economic constraints and the strength of the, when I say opposition, I don't mean the political opposition in the assembly. I mean all of the opposition to the process, which obviously includes the powerful economic sectors. For all of the things that, you know, has been said about Venezuela, and, you know, the implications that, oh, you know, this is a repeat of failed socialist model, failed Soviet model, the vast majority of the Venezuelan economy beyond the oil has remained in private hands, including the production, transport, and distribution of food. So obviously, you know, those are things to kind of take into account and learn from the future. And when you know, people are looking at why are people having to line up for food that or to purchase things which, for example, are readily available here in Ecuador. Tell Us Where English is based out of Ecuador, the same products, harina pan, for example, which is corn flour, but that's a brand name. Polar, which is the manufacturer and distributor of things, those things are readily available in Colombia and Ecuador, but they're not available in Venezuela. And that's in large part because of there's a concerted effort to underproduce. There's a concerted effort to hoard goods in order to then sell these things on a black market to speculate, and because of the subsidies in order to that were implemented in order to improve the lives of the broad section of society. Those subsidies have meant that the foods get taken out of Venezuela to be sold at the black market in Colombia, for example. It's a difficult situation in Venezuela, but nonetheless, there is resistance to the efforts by the opposition to remove Maduro. There's also one of the things that the opposition has been focused on is to try to implement an amnesty law that would free not only these high-profile politicians who have been jailed, but also folks. There's 50 crimes that are included in that amnesty law, including fraud, including terrorism, including possession of handguns in public spaces. There's lots of people that are currently serving jail time for things that they were convicted of doing that are not anywhere near anything critical that could be freed as a result of this. And obviously, this has got a lot of Venezuelans angry and worried.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is a concerted offensive, and listeners should realize that we talk about strikes, we talk about worker strikes, but the capitalists strike too. That was very clear in Chile in the 1970s to bring the economy to a halt. The first steps are to hoard goods, to cause shortages of currency and real goods themselves, to send money out of the country, all the things that you just described. But these are tactical expressions of business capitalists going on strike to cause the crisis, intensify it, so then they can take full control of the political levers. We are in various stages of that, I think, in all these three countries. It needs to be watched closely because, the whole process is going to continue. But it's good to hear that there is a popular resistance beginning to mobilize, not just, in the streets, but politically, maybe eventually with some counter programs and proposals that are necessary here to, provide a resistance along multiple lines. One last area maybe you could comment on before we're almost through here. Well, actually, two things. Before we go, I want you to make sure you tell the listeners where they can go for Telesort to follow information here. And then I want to ask you one more question about what is the status of military and police joining. Okay, one more minute. Quickly, where can listeners go?
All right. Well, they can. All our stuff is published online at www.telesurtv.net/English, and you'll get all of our information there.
Okay, very good. Well, we don't have too much time here, maybe 30 seconds, 40 seconds or more, but. In Latin America, we've always had military police intervention. What's the status quickly? I think we're running out of time, Pablo. Pablo, we're going to have to have you back here in a few more weeks or months or something to give us an update. Are you willing to do that? Okay, Pablo is gone, and this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. We're going to return to this and follow these events in Latin America as they unfold in the coming weeks.